From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Angler. Andrew Hudgens, professor of creative writing at The Ohio State University, is the author of 6 books of poetry, including Saints and Strangers, a 1985 Pulitzer Prize finalist. Welcome, Andrew, to Writer's Talk.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start with your most recently published book. It's called Shut Up, You're Fine, Poems for Very, Very Bad Children. Now, while the title is unusual, I want to assure everyone that the book is full of heartwarming poems about children, such as The Dying Boy's Lament, I Think of Being in the Grave, and When Granddad Says, Please Kill Me. What was your elevator talk while you were writing these poems?
I'd been working on it for about 8 years, and it was only after a while that people started to say, how would you describe this book? And so I had to sit down and say that it was like Robert Louis Stevenson writing his childhood children's poems for South Park. Mm-hmm. And I'd always hated Robert Louis Stevenson's children's poems. He seemed syrupy to me, and I'd always got a kick out of Beavis and Butthead, South Park, Family Guy, The Simpsons, things like that.
Mm-hmm. See, I assumed that these books followed from some really bad experiences with children.
That too. I had taught 6th grade for a year.
Ah.
And then I committed suicide.
Mm-hmm. And ended up at OSU. After
heaven.
Heaven. All right. Well, the poems seem to follow in the footsteps of Shock-Headed Peter tales, and I found it funny that Amazon appends a subtitle after Shut Up, You're Fine. It's called Instructive Poetry for Very, Very Bad Children. But that doesn't seem to be your intent. I don't think you're trying to instruct children in these.
No. My original subtitle had been Troubling Poems for Troubled Children, which I thought was funny. But Barnes & Noble and Borders didn't. They thought it would attract actual children to read the book.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people use that idea of the fake, you know, pretend that you're writing for children because it's a little more shocking when people think that the poem, somewhere in their brain, they think it was intended for children, mm-hmm. even when it really wasn't.
Right. And so you haven't tested these on children. No children were injured in the...
Actually, one of the poems, which is, I forget the title, My Father's Corpse or something like, I think is the title, in which it was based on a real incident that I'd written as a serious poem, in which my father would just lie down on the bed and he wouldn't move and we would crawl on him until we started thinking he was dead. Mm-hmm. And he was pretending to be dead. And then we'd start picking at him and poking at him, trying to get a response out of him. And if you think about it, there's no way this can end well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, either we're going to end up thinking he's dead, or we're going to do something to make him prove he isn't dead.
Mm-hmm.
And usually we would go too far, and he would get upset and hurt, physically hurt, and come roaring out of the bed screaming. So I wrote a poem about that. And it's been used by the NEA in their read-aloud program for children. So every now and then I hear about a kid in West Virginia or Montana reading this to a group of assembled parents.
Why would they choose that poem to read to children?
Well, I think because it's funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kids think it's funny, and parents sometimes get disturbed by it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's because I rhyme quotum and scrotum,
mm-hmm.
and that's why I think the parents get upset.
It's an odd poem to choose. And it's why
kids like it, because they get to stand in front of their parents and their teachers and say, scrotum.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Well, I think Paul is enjoying that right now as the sound engineer. Well, what is your favorite poem in this book? What ones are you really interested in?
They're my babies. I like them all. But one that I can actually read to you is a poem, maybe not as funny as the others, called Margaret and Her Puppy Ralph. Margaret dressed her puppy Ralph in Mama's hot pink beret. She draped pink ribbons on his neck and knelt with him to pray. He wiggled in her chubby arms and tried to lick her face when she dressed him in flannel gowns adorned with bright pink lace. But as her puppy Ralph grew up, he chewed her flannel gown. He gnawed off Barbie's legs and head, then knocked poor Margaret down. He licked her salty tears away while she curled on the ground, wept, hiccuped, sobbed, and caterwauled. So Mom drove to the pound, and Margaret stared across the seat and studied like a scholar the chewed and faded scrap of pink still hanging from Ralph's collar. Now, maybe that's funny, maybe it's not. I happen to think that it's both.
I think it's surprisingly poignant in the collection there. That's one that I thought really crossed grounds between being funny in sort of this, like you say, South Park way. There must be a different term for that than South Parkian. But it also was, you know, evoking these real sort of emotional response because the girl's dog has turned out to be, you know, a real problem that they can't deal with. And it's very interesting to consider, you know, that as a sort of transgressive kind of poetry.
That's actually based mildly on something that really happened. My wife and I had a young, cheerful dog, and he loved kids. But he loved them so much he would jump on them and knock them down. And they would fall to the ground, and if they started crying, he was quite happy because they're on the ground, they're easy for him to lick. Mm-hmm. If they're crying, they have tears, which taste good, apparently. So the kid's screaming, terrified. The dog's happy as a clam. I'm almost laughing, but my friends, whose child it is, are horrified. And a lot of it's perspective, because I knew the dog was not in the least intending to hurt the child.
Yeah, or would leave large pieces of the child at least.
For them to take home.
Right, yeah. So what kind of feedback have you gotten about the book with poetry like that?
Mixed. People who think of poetry as only a noble endeavor are upset. And the word that seems to appear most often in reviews is disturbing, which is, I think, kind of funny because there's nothing in this book you wouldn't see in an average 2-hour slice of primetime television. And certainly nothing as wild as what you would hear on a comedy routine on the Comedy Channel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tell me about the illustrations by Barry Moser.
Barry is a wonderful illustrator, book designer, and I met him at a conference in Santa Fe. We were both working there. I was teaching poetry writing, and he was teaching figure drawing, I believe. And I read some of the poems, and he laughed and said that he would like to illustrate the book when it came out. I didn't believe him. I was kind of just blown away with this idea. But we were there the next year. He said it again, and he said it very seriously. So I was thrilled to have Barry Moser design and illustrate your book is a wonderful thing.
Did he choose which ones he wanted to, or did you tell him that I'd like to have this one illustrated in a particular way?
I don't know that anyone's ever done that with Barry telling them what you want him to do. Barry designed the book, chose the what he wanted to illustrate, and did a wonderful job.
Okay.
I had absolutely no say in what he did, and that made me happy.
Okay. Why did that make you happy? You didn't want to have to dictate?
You realize that you're in the hands of somebody who really, really knows what he's doing. Let him do it.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that, when I was looking through the illustrations that we can show a couple, I think, that they're all done in, they're all these ink drawings, and they're all dark and sort of heavy with the ink in a really interesting way. And he's chosen just the worst specimens you can imagine. There's a little kid smoking a cigarette in one of them. There's a... the poem that you talked about with the father playing dead has an illustration at the end of the father's reaction to being injured.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a really interesting play between the pictures and the text. So it's good to
racked
hear that.
Racked is the word you're looking for.
What's that?
It's not injured. He's racked.
Racked with
you remember that from word from when you were a kid? People still use that?
Yeah, I've heard the racked with pain. Yeah, that would describe the poor father in this. Mm-hmm. What we had talked earlier about some of the shock-headed Peter things, and I think you've got something that also relates to that.
Some
poems that you sort of follow in the footsteps of.
Yeah, there are a lot of books in this kind of tradition of fake children's poems. One of the earliest one was by Hilaire Belloc. I can't remember exactly when these were written. I think early in the last century. And it's called Cautionary Tales for Children. And the subtitle is Designed for the Admonition of Children Between the Ages of 8 and 14 Years. And here's one of them. This is Henry King, who chewed bits of string and was early cut off in dreadful agonies. The chief defect of Henry King was chewing little bits of string. At last, he swallowed some which tied itself in ugly knots inside. Physicians of the utmost fame were called at once, but when they came, they answered, as they took their fees, there is no cure for this disease. Henry will very soon be dead. His parents stood about his bed, lamenting his untimely death. When Henry, with his latest breath, cried, "Oh, my friends, be warned by me that breakfast, dinner, lunch, and tea are all the human frame requires." With that, the wretched child expires. Now, that is not really for children, but it's pretty darn funny. And there's an even weirder book called Ruthless Rhymes for Heartless Homes, published in 1896 or 98, that's in a similar vein, but even wickeder. And Edward Gorey in our time did similar things. But they're all very British, very formal, very distant, and I wanted to do something rawer and, to my mind, more American.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about Charles Adams? Do you feel the presence of somebody like Charles Adams?
Absolutely. When I was a kid, one of the things that I would do is I would go into the library and just take all the cartoon books off the shelves and just sit with them for hours. So I would do New Yorker cartoons 1930, New Yorker cartoons 1931, 32, and I would just go through all of them. And Charles Adams, he would leap out at you when you were a kid. I mean, you knew before you read a word that you were looking at a Charles Adams cartoon, and they were very exciting.
It's funny because it's sort of the illustrations in this kind of evoked Charles Adams for me. But Charles Adams seemed like a thinner line than Barry Moser, who's got a very sort of heavy kind of. There's a lot of black ink on the page when you're looking at these. Tell me about when you were writing this book. What were your writing? Well, I know it was written over a long time, but what are your writing habits or processes? How do you get into writing this versus, say, some of your other work, which I think is not intended to be funny? How do you change?
These things are easier than writing something that involves a lot of thought and a visceral response and an intellectual response that you're trying to work out. All you have to do with something like this is make it funny. So we've all seen those, we've seen TV shows where the writers are sitting there throwing ideas back and forth, taking a scene, refining it, making it funny, throw out this line, turn this phrase. That's what you're doing by sitting by yourself. Mm-hmm. And it just takes a lot of patience, and every now and then you show it to somebody who'll, you know, kick it around and say, "That's not funny," or "This is not as good as it could be," or "You could make that rhyme sharper." And then you go back and you fiddle with it again, but it's really kind of distanced tinkering. It takes a ton of time, but you don't get up jittery and distraught at the end of the day as you do when you're trying to describe something that's almost past the edge of your own understanding.
Mm-hmm. When you give things to other people, do you give them to people in the English department? I'm curious because, or in other English departments, departments of English, it seems like that humor is one of the things that isn't necessarily welcome sometimes by more serious study of where you might give it to someone and they would say, oh, this isn't serious. I mean, you're tenured here, and so that helps. But do you have people that respond, I don't want to read the funny stuff, I only want to read the serious stuff, the really...
Absolutely. That really absolutely happened with these poems. There are a lot of poets, including friends of mine, who the idea of humorous poems makes them very unhappy. And so they didn't even want to look at them. Certain editors said to me, I don't want to see any more of these poems. Whereas, other editors thought, who'd never been interested in what I was doing, said, well, I like this. You find a different audience for different things. And one of the things that I learned when I started showing to people is that there are certain people that I actually think it's true with any project. There's certain people that are going to be tuned into that particular project that you're working on and certain that aren't. And you just kind of have to keep trying it in front of people before you find the person whose comments you go, yes, that is right, and I can take those suggestions. And early on, I'll give you an example. I had a friend, somebody I had worked with at a writer's conference. He was actually my student in the class, but brilliant, well-read man. And when I sent him an early version of this book, he wrote back and he said, Andrew, I know you like slant rhymes, but slant rhymes don't work for humor. And I thought, he's absolutely right. If I'm going to do these poems, they have to be exact rhymes. And so I had to start at the beginning with every one of the poems and look at them and rethink them in terms of that wonderful and, in retrospect, obvious piece of advice.
How closely did you try to follow to sort of nursery rhymes that were in your head? When you're talking about writing, giving up on slant rhymes, that's a really technical thing, to going into the full rhyme. How often did you think, I like this because it reminds me of the scan of a nursery rhyme that you have in your head?
A good number of times. For instance, you mentioned the Dying Boy's Lament. I was thinking about those cowboy songs that I'd sung when... do people still sing those in
elementary
schools? As I walked out in the streets of Laredo.
I don't know that they do anymore, but I was...
Did they when you were a kid?
Well, I had my parents' record collection, and I did the Kingston Trio, and that's how I came about that.
Okay, because we used to bellow these things out in class. The Marine Corps hymn we sang, Off We Go Into the Wild Blue Yonder. The Dying Cowboy's Lament, all of those things, kind of quite morbid things that we would, so that was fun.
Okay. Tell me about getting a book deal. You were talking about having people that didn't like this stuff, even though you're an established poet. What sort of advice do you have for new people that are out there working in poetry? Is the landscape good for poetry right now?
Not particularly. There's been a real shrinkage in the university press's funding, and that's where most poetry is published. Commercial houses under a lot of stress, and poetry's not a big money maker. But I had my agent. I have rarely enough for a poet. I have an agent who's taken on some prose projects for me, and she was good enough to represent this book. And Overlook was a great press to go to. They understand book layout. They understood an odd project like this one, and they were just champs all the way through. And they're famous for doing beautiful books, and I think they did a beautiful job with this book.
Okay. What's the best part about being a writer for you? What do you really look forward to, say, on this project or some of your other projects?
I don't even know. it's something I get up and do, and enjoy doing. Sometimes it's stressful, and sometimes it's, you know, your viscera get involved with it, and you get jittery and upset. But it's a job of work. It's a job. It's challenging and a pleasure, and it's something. The hardest thing for me to come to terms with early was that you're always a failure. I mean, you establish the bar at how high and how good a failure you can create, because even the greatest poems have limitations. I mean, we could sit and talk about the limitations of King Lear if we wanted to, but that doesn't mean that it's not a great work. But I'm sure that if we asked Shakespeare, he would acknowledge there were things in it he would like to redo, rethink, things that made him unhappy.
Mm-hmm. That's a, I guess, goes maybe with the theme of the book being a little bit negative. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of it's always going to be a failure. What about it's always also going to be a success? That doesn't seem to be the what motivates you, that there's always going to be really successful lines. You'll get a really good line mm-hmm. and think, go around quoting it?
I did not to quote my own lines, but I will quote other people's lines if I can remember them, which I don't always. And usually I remember the dirty ones better than the clean ones.
So I can't ask you to share today.
No, you really can't. But unless you like really filthy limericks on air. But I don't know that things can... Failure... I mean, both success and failure are infinite, I suppose, but it seems to me we're more likely to veer off into failure seems a deeper hole than success seems high as a mountain.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What's the best writing job you've had? You mentioned that you were a teacher of mm-hmm. Sixth graders. I don't know how much writing was involved in that, but what's...
None.
Okay. What's something that
Except
really...
Except detention cards. I wrote detention cards.
Okay, what really helped prepare you to be a writer when you were younger?
Reading, you know, I was one of those people that just sucked down words. My brother and I had fist fights over who got to read the cereal box at breakfast. Hmm. He would turn the back of it toward him, I would turn the back of it toward me. And then we would be rolling across the floor fighting about who got to do the reading. You know, I would pick up anything. I'd go to the library, whatever it had, I read. And you really can't be a writer unless you have an awful lot of, I mean, just think of what reading gives you. It gives you the words, it gives you all the sentence structures, it gives you the stories, it gives you a sense of the psychology of the relationship between you and a reader, and between you as a reader and that writer. There's no way you can become a writer without being a reader.
Okay. Is your brother a writer now?
No, he's a doctor.
He's a doctor? Okay. Well, he writes prescriptions, things
I'm
like
sure
that.
I'm sure he does.
What would you do if you weren't a writer, you weren't a professor? What's your fallback career?
I don't know that I would have one. I would love to be a folk singer, except I can't play guitar or sing.
Okay.
And that's, you know, I'd love to be a painter, except I can't paint. My interests, I mean, are in artistic things, but this is the thing that I can do.
Okay.
I don't know. I've wondered sometimes about sales. I hate being dependent on other people's decisions as you are as a salesman. Mm-hmm. But so many of the salesmen I see pay no attention to the psychology of the people they're dealing with. Whereas a writer, you have to be aware of how the reader's brain works. Mm-hmm. So I wonder about that. I wonder if a writer is a version of a salesman.
Hmm. Could be. What genre haven't you written that you'd like to try? You've got a series of essays called The Glass Anvil.
Mm-hmm.
Out, and you've got these six books of poetry. What else?
I like writing personal essays, I always wondered what it would be like to write a humor column, you know, something that came on a regular basis.
Like Dave Barry.
Like Dave Barry or Gene Weingarten at the Washington Post or something like Thurber. I don't know quite who does those anymore. There's one guy, the political guy, whose name's not going to come to me. Mm-hmm. And but, you know, newspapers really don't have those humor columnists anymore. I guess people are doing it online now.
All right, well, you've been on Slate online.
Yes.
You had a poem on Andrew Serrano, I think.
Yes.
I may not be getting...
Andre Serrano, who had that photograph called Piss Christ of a crucifix in a vat of cow's blood and urine. And it was a very controversial photograph, right, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was beautiful. I thought it was a gorgeous photograph and a theologically powerful statement.
Okay. And but you're making the move to online. You're seeing mm-hmm. poetry online. And what do you think of the future of that as a publication?
I don't know. I mean, I grew up as a print guy. I love the feel of holding the book in my hand. I wonder what it would be like to read poems on a Kindle, to be able to take it and hold it in my hand. The reading experience online is complicated because 2,000 words is going to seem very long online. Mm-hmm. And on the page, it's short. It's just, you know, print it out, it's 4 or 5 pages. Online, that seems like an eternity. So people have argued that publishing on the web is kind of the perfect forum for poetry. Maybe so, because I find myself reading more and more poems online. But even that scattered, you don't sit down and read 60 pages of a single author's work as you do when you're sitting down with somebody's book. Mm-hmm. So it's a different experience and one I'm trying to understand.
Mm-hmm. And you can't take the Kindle to the bathtub.
I suppose you could, but you wouldn't want to drop it.
Right, yeah, it's a big problem. That will be the next book.
But we've all dropped books in the tub, haven't we?
Yeah.
And got those wrinkledy pages.
What's your secret vice of an author or a genre? What would surprise people that you read? I mean, with some of the writings, I suspect that your reading goes pretty far afield.
Mm-hmm.
But what's something that would surprise people that you read?
I doubt that it would surprise people that I'm a sucker for hard-boiled detective fiction. Mm-hmm. I've been rereading and Richard Stark, which is Donald Westlake's, mm-hmm. One of his pseudonyms, and so he's got that character Parker, who's a real hard-nosed, murderous mm-hmm. Criminal, and I'm very fond of those.
It just came out as a cartoon.
Yeah,
a
I've comic. Got that, and I haven't read it yet. Yeah. Yeah, and history, I read a lot of history, but that probably, I don't know, I don't know how to do anything.
I was hoping for a Harlequin romance or something.
No. Never.
How about we end with you reading one more poem out of that? Shut up your fine there under your leg. And,
I would love to.
All right.
This is a poem beautifully illustrated by Barry Moser of Exploding Squirrels. If you're a gardener, you hate squirrels, and all of the poems that I know celebrate squirrels. The Circus in the Trees. I love to watch the gray squirrels leap from limb to leafy limb, tumbling like furry acrobats, and every tree their gym. The oak limbs are their trampoline, and their trapeze the pines. They stroll like tightrope walkers up the looping power lines, and sometimes they gnaw through a line, exploding as it arcs, and lighting up the evening sky, cascading down as sparks.
Professor Andrew Hudgens, I thank you for coming on to Writer's Talk.
Thank you.
We will look for your book, Shut Up, You're Fine, Poems for Very, Very Bad Children.